The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. A word for you today, a little treat. Circumbendibus. We're going to have no circumbendibus answers today. It's a 17th century word, which means an answer or an argument so convoluted and evasive that it isn't really an answer at all. My guests are warned, no circumbendibus answers this evening. Just clear, concise communication. We'll talk to Brett Botten, Chief Executive of SPAR. George Glenos will join us with a view on tomorrow's Monetary Policy Committee meeting. A massive capital raise by a South African startup. Why it is that the South African financial services sector cannot unseat eBucks as the country's best loyalty program in the financial sector. And then the chairman of SA Olive is a guy called Nick Wilkinson, all about the South African olive industry. I've been reading a lot about the olive industry recently, and I thought you should learn more about it too. We'll do that this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, SPAR taking a knock on the day, along with Woolworths. We'll talk about both of those with our market commentator, Chris Stewart, this evening. Turnover was up nearly 3%, but its profits got hit by the July riots. And of course, while its businesses in Ireland and Switzerland performed well, Poland's still problematic. Brett Botten is the chief executive of SPAR Group. And I suppose being a KZN headquartered company, Brett, the riots take on a particular poignancy, relevance and pain.
Bruce, they did indeed. It was really, across my mind, back to that week in July, terrible time for our country. We had 180-odd stores impacted. Pleasingly, we managed to rebuild about 130, so we have 50 stores that are still closed as at the end of the year, 20 of which are SPAR stores. Most of those will be rebuilt in few months going forward now, with about 20-odd stores across all of our banners being long-term rebuild projects. But they're all coming back online. Our retailers have been incredible with the help of their staff and the community. So we're positive about that, but certainly it did impact us in that sort of month of July for sure.
SPAR is different from other retailers in that you own massive distribution centres, 7 across the country when I last checked. And then the retailers you supply are independent. They're people who own their own shops and they choose to put the SPAR logo above the door. Who is responsible, therefore, for the rebuilds? Are these the responsibility of the individuals, the store owners themselves, or do you get involved?
Yes, so the financing or the funding of that will happen by the individuals, but bear in mind most of those will be subject to insurance claims, and we've received, sure. We've been working with our retailers in chasing down these insurance claims. So many of them have been paid out and have received the insurance claim, but we have worked with them to source equipment to go into the stores, like point-of-sale material, and where damaged equipment was damaged in the store. So we work with them, but at the end of the day, they're responsible for the funding. We have assisted them. We've frozen debt, for instance, where stores have been closed down, and obviously they haven't been able to trade, so we've frozen their trading accounts until they're up and running and they're able to then get into a position to repay, or unless they get insurance payouts in the interim. So yes, certainly we've helped them, but at the end of the day, it's the retailer's responsibility to fund whatever work is to be done.
So, I mean, in a mix of riots and destruction of property, the booze bans and the liquor prohibition and the cigarette sales bans at various lockdowns, I mean, a huge amount of damage, I'm sure, has been done to the cash flows of the individual retailers.
Yeah, Bruce, that's for sure. And, you know, with regard to liquor, so our liquor performance in the year was pretty strong, up 11-odd%, but we're still 6% behind where we were in 2019. It's about 500 million rand at constant pricing. So it just shows you how much this has hurt our business. The fact that we lost one-third of the available days, ironically, is very similar to what happened in 2020. But in 2021, the days that we lost were Friday, Saturday, Sunday trading mostly. And that's good. That's big business for us in Tops. And next door, the SPAR store next door, where a consumer will come in and go to the Tops store and then go next door to buy maybe whatever he's going to buy to bra, perhaps. We lost that business as well. So definitely impacted our retailers. And in some stores where Tops played a bigger role proportionately than, say, some of the smaller stores, for instance, where Tops is a bigger contributor to his overall profit or profitability, obviously a bigger role there. And that has certainly been an issue for us to deal with and manage with our independent retail network.
I mean, have other shopping patterns changed? I remember talking to Pick and Pay a while back, and they were saying there are fewer visits but bigger baskets. And I wonder whether your community stores, your suburban stores, have lost customers to the bigger shops and the bigger chains rather than the quick neighbourhood stop, which people might have done once or twice a day or two or three times a week or whatever. In order to avoid COVID, people have gone to mega stores rather than to the little local shops.
We have seen some of that this, so we have seen a bit of a drop in footfall but an increase in basket. Obviously, some of our stores are, you know, we do have some much bigger stores which have gained, and we saw that in during the COVID lockdown period, we saw huge spikes in those stores. So we have certainly lost some footfall in some of the smaller stores, which is something that we're dealing with and managing as we move forward into next year.
Unusually, one of the smarter things that a South African food retailer has done is gone and bought other retail operations that have actually worked. And you've got a business in Ireland, which has also got shops in the south of England. The Swiss business of Spar has also turned around quite nicely. The Polish business of Spar, though, is proving to be something of a drag.
Bruce, yeah. So you rightly say, you know, we're delighted with the performance of our Irish business. A really strong business, well run, on the back of an incredible performance in 2020. So for them to deliver the profits that they've delivered is really something special. Our Swiss business, we were under pressure for a number of years, but they've come good, and we've actually held on to what we've gained through the lockdown period. So really, very excited about our Swiss business. Coming on to Poland, yeah, it's a very disappointing result for us. And I was fortunate because in the last little while, late October, myself and our CFO, Mark Godfrey, we spent almost a week in Poland. So we've been there to have a look at the work we've done, and we've really made great strides in setting up the business for success from a distribution center perspective, from onboarding of retailers. But it's not translating into numbers, which obviously at the end of the day is what it's about. And we're under no illusions as to the amount of pressure we're under and what we need to do to deliver to the benefit of all of our stakeholders. So we made two key decisions while we were there in Poland. The one is around the contract that we have, or the contractual obligation that we have with our retailers in the south, where we've made some changes there. We're getting them to sign new contracts which are less onerous from our perspective. And we might end up losing some retailers because they don't want to come onto the new arrangement that we have. But so be it. We just don't have enough support from them to support the infrastructure we have. So that's happening as we speak. It will allow us also, we might lose some business, but we're going on a drive to recruit new members. We are targeting to bring on about 10% additional store numbers in the new year. And the other decision we took while we were there was to rationalize our distribution center and logistics warehousing facility. So we currently have three facilities, one in Kaminka, one in Chelach, and one near Warsaw. The Warsaw one we're using to cross-dock fresh produce and dairy items down to the south, but we're ending up transporting that the long distances. So we're going to close down that facility and rationalize into two facilities in the south, and that will help us from an optimization of our facilities and set us up well.
And have you put South African management in Poland in the same way as your predecessors did in Switzerland, or sort of the old SAB model of taking hard talent from South Africa and taking the systems and processes and putting them in there?
Yes, that's what we've done, Bruce. We've got two South Africans on the ground in Poland, based in our central office in Poznan. We're sending in a third person, and then we've recruited a Polish person into our retail operations side of things. He has extensive experience with international Spa. He comes from Gdansk, so he's a Polish national, but he's fluent in English, which is helping us in the interaction with retail. So we're building a nice strong team there and setting ourselves up nicely for next year to turn that business around.
Brett Botten, the Spar Group Chief Executive. On to George Denos now, Head of Research at ETM Analytics. 5% inflation number today. No shock there, George. But is the Reserve Bank going to buckle under pressure and raise interest rates tomorrow, do you think?
I don't know that they're under that much pressure, but I think it's the prudent thing to do. These interest rate decisions, and I don't envy the MPC tomorrow. I think they've got quite a tough call to make. There's a lot to take into consideration. On the one hand, you've got an economy that's obviously still struggling and muddling along and trying to recoup what's lost, not just from the riots, but obviously lockdowns, etc. On the other hand, you've got central banks around the world that are are lifting rates. You've got an inflation theme that is permeating most countries around the world, including South Africa, albeit that ours is quite contained. And in fact, we're sitting in an odd situation where our inflation rate at the moment is lower than that of the US. So,
yeah.
But you know, that aside, we need to keep an element of competitiveness insofar as interest rates are concerned, and I think the Reserve Bank's mindful of that. Not doing so potentially leaves things like the currency a little more vulnerable to an economic shock should it arise, or susceptible to bouts of rand weakness, which would be unhelpful in the longer term sort of containment of inflation expectations. So there's a lot for them to consider. I think that even if they had to raise, and I'm sure the governor would so much as say this, but even with interest rates a good 100 basis points or maybe even 150 basis points higher, we wouldn't regard those as particularly contractionary. And they're not. This isn't the problem. Interest rate levels in South Africa are not the problem. The problem very much rests with government performance, service delivery, fiscal risks. That's where the real issues sit. For now, I think that the Reserve Bank's in the normalization of monetary policy movie, and so they'll probably embark on that tomorrow. We're anticipating that they'll move 25 basis points. If it doesn't happen this meeting, it'll probably happen next. But, you know, you've got to start that journey, and, you know, now seems to be as good a time as any.
Thank you, George Glenos, the head of research at ETM Analytics.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
And on to another story. It's an astonishing story of a 750 million rand capital raise by a South African fintech and payments business called Ozo, which makes sure that you can pay your bills. You can pay companies like ShopRite when you go there and swipe your card, or Takealot when you put your details into the payment engine, or MTN or Vodacom or Uber. And they've done this enormous capital raise, 750 million rand, to Chief Executive Thomas Pays on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. This must be one of the bigger fundraisers in fintech in recent times, Thomas.
I would assume so. If anything, it's about 2.5 times the size of Uber's Series B. So it is indeed quite a sensational historical moment for fintech in South Africa and Africa, Bruce.
What is the connection here to Tencent in China, of course, which is part owned by Naspers? Why are they involved?
Look, I think Tencent is always on the lookout for hyperscale businesses that can drive an impact anywhere in the world. More recently, there's been a strong focus on the African continent, and about March this year, Tencent had heard about some of the amazing work that Ozo was doing from a financial and digital inclusion, not only from a buzzword perspective, but also literally from an action and delivering on tech, you know, that could enable payment for millions of South Africans that did not have a credit card, as an example. So,
you're processing about 1.5 billion rand at the moment in payments monthly. How is this new capital raise going to affect your ability to scale up what it is you're already doing?
No, as any fintech, our role is to enhance and automate financial services and processes. If we look at the opportunity with regard to payment, there's in excess of 9 trillion rand that are being processed in South Africa a year just from a bank transfer perspective. So we barely cover 0.1% of the opportunity at this stage. So there's a lot of requirement from human capital resources needed in order to start addressing the need of all South Africans. Looking at it from a credit card perspective, there's hardly 9 million credit cards that are active in South Africa due to the high cost of transacting to them. Yet there's over 47 million bank account holders. And with such a strong focus and need to address in the market, there's a requirement of a significant investment to be able to do so in a safe and secure way, as we've done for the past 7 years.
And, I mean, safe, secure, and quite conservative in the terms of a continued focus on South Africa, primarily South Africa, all South Africa for the foreseeable future?
Absolutely. We, you know, we've seen tremendous growth in the South African market, especially in the township areas. We've been able to see an incredible number with over 140,000 users joining us every single month. But it's a problem that we need to address outside South Africa too. So a small portion of this capital will also be used in order to expand in other African markets and address the similar needs that we're seeing in Africa with bank-to-bank payments.
Thank you, Thomas Pays, the chief executive at Ozo. It's a payments system business, and they are growing and developing and have raised this money. And I just always love the names that come up here. And when we've seen other capital raises by other South African companies, you see the name of Michael Dell and his foundation come to the fore, Michael and Susan Dell Foundation. Today, I see for the first time linked to a South African business raising capital is the LinkedIn founder, Reid Hoffman. He's also with Endeavor and with Tencent, these guys who move in these highfalutin circles. Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, somehow connected to this transaction as well.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
And on to Chris Stewart from 91, who is our market commentator this evening. And another record day for the JSE, not worth dwelling on. We were up only 3 points by the close, but still, records are records. Disappointing results out of Woolies and Spar, and both of those getting punished today quite severely, Chris.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. Woolies and Spar really, I guess, pulling up the bottom end of the table today based on their performance. Woolworths coming out with a 20-week trading update. And also, interestingly and quite prematurely, an earnings guidance for the first half of their financial year. So that's for the 6 months to the end of December. Now, given how important November and December trading typically is for the earnings outcome of retailers, you know, clearly things are a little bit behind schedule if they're going to put out a trading update talking about earnings at this early stage. But if you look at the turnover numbers that they did provide, you know, by and large, we would have expected David Jones and Country Road in Australia to be weak, given the very restrictive lockdown conditions that have prevailed over the period in those particular jurisdictions. The fashion, beauty and home business showing something of an improvement, but again, they had indicated at the 7 week period what their trading was doing in that part of the business, and there's been a dramatic deceleration since then, partly because their annual clearance sale was brought forward this year and came in inside a little bit earlier inside that first 7 week period. So we've seen a slowdown there, but I think the most perhaps the most concerning part of the announcement from the market's perspective was the fact that the food business, the core food business in South Africa, only growing at about 3.2%. And I think the market would have had high expectations for that business, particularly in light of the fairly robust trading update we saw out of ShopRite recently. And it does appear as though ShopRite, relative to its competitors, doing much, much better in the core food space, Bruce.
Yeah, it's been a tough period for these guys. I mean, I suppose most interesting for me in terms of the Woolies update is that there's been a leap of 26% in online sales, and online sales in Woolworths now make up 15% of total turnover. That is a stat I wasn't expecting to see, but it's a very clear sign, I suppose, of demographics and lockdowns not only here but in Australia as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's an indication of the demographic to which they serve, and there's obviously an LSM grouping who probably have a greater ability to conduct their shopping online and a greater comfort level in doing so. But just generally, we are seeing the whole e-commerce theme gaining more and more legs, and I think that's a trend that's inevitably going to carry on, regardless of what happens in terms of COVID and how safe people feel about going shopping again. I think once you've gone through the convenience of buying online, it's difficult to regress, Bruce.
Nah, some of us have survived it. Some of us have survived it, Chris. Tongaat Hulett raising capital. Now, what's really interesting about this is by the time this capital raise is done, Tongaat Hulett is effectively going to be a Mauritius company, or at least owned by a Mauritian shareholder, controlled by a Mauritian shareholder. I think that was quite an interesting development.
Yeah, I mean, it was always on the cards. I mean, you know, their balance sheet is not sustainable. They've been under lots and lots of pressure from their funders to raise capital. They had indicated a few weeks ago that, you know, they did put out a cautionary, if I remember correctly. And, you know, clearly deciding now's the time to let the market know that they will be raising a considerable amount of capital to shore up their balance sheet, partly underwritten. And as you indicate, you know, new shareholders coming in and potentially taking an increasing portion of the company through an equity underwrite of that rights issue. You know, a reasonable proportion of the existing shareholders have said that they will follow their rights. And I have a suspicion that the rights issue will be priced at such a level that if you elect not to follow your rights, you're going to be very heavily diluted indeed. So it'll be interesting to see exactly where the rights issue is priced. That doesn't make a difference. As long as you follow your rights, just makes a difference to the number of shares in issue, ex post versus ex ante. Yeah, that is a long-awaited balance sheet repair taking place, and something that I think is being thrust upon them by those other parties owning the 7 billion rand odd worth of debt that sits on Tongaat's balance sheet still.
And then finally, a view on interest rates tomorrow. George Glenos at ETM Analytics telling us this evening it would be the right thing to do. I don't think he truly believes the Reserve Bank is going to raise rates tomorrow. It's possible. What's your view?
Yeah, usually I've been getting off quite easily in the last few years. It's been a fairly easy call. I think we've got a market that's fairly evenly split in terms of those who say they will and won't hike. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I don't think we're going to see a hike tomorrow. The inflation numbers today were fairly benign. If you strip out some of the supply side factors, there's not any great evidence of demand side inflation. Retail sales numbers still fairly weak today. So I think it's a much, much closer call than we've had at any stage in the last couple of years, Bruce. But I still think the SARB is going to wait until early next year.
I would concur. We'll see whether or not we're right tomorrow. Chris Stewart at 91, tonight's market commentator.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Let's rather learn more about the olives business, because I remember the day. It's one of those moments. I know where I was when Diana died. I know where I was when Nelson Mandela died. And I also know where I was the day I had an olive I liked. I must have been about 21 years old. It was a Greek restaurant in Melville. And this most glorious Kalamata olive just exploded in my mouth. Oh, up until that point, I think olives that I'd come across had become pre-sliced in tins and tasted like the can more than the olive. But it did get me thinking about South Africa's growing olive industry. The chairman at SA Olive is Nick Wilkinson on the line to us from the Western Cape this evening. The olive industry goes back a long way. I think the first trees were planted in South Africa way back in 1661.
Yeah, that's correct, Bruce. We have a long history associated with the olive production in South Africa.
That's all well and good, but and there was, I think, a commercial start in the 1920s. But when was there actually the boom that we're enjoying today in terms of the huge variety and assortment of South African grown olives, and the huge boom we see in oil as well?
Yeah, I would say it's over the last 20 years there's been significant growth, along with the trends across the world with increased consumption of olive oil.
And so the last 20 years, I mean, what has been the catalyst then for this massive expansion in the oil trade?
I think it's the proverbial Mediterranean diet and people looking for longevity and making sure the proverbial they are what they eat. And so they trend towards, as their education improves, wanting to eat better and better and more healthy products.
But we could import it cheaper. We could bring the stuff in from elsewhere. What's led to the explosion of production in South Africa?
I think the fact you're saying that you can import it cheaper from elsewhere is a little bit of a misnomer. You need to compare like with like. And the quality profile of South African olive oil is far superior than the average import. In fact, you might find it surprising to know that some of our producers export oil across the globe. and the oil fetches premium prices far higher than South Africa in these foreign markets. And that's just a reflection on the quality profile that we produce.
Okay, now that doesn't surprise me because the quality is very good, but we wouldn't have known that before the industry. Was there one particular person, was there one particular organization, a co-op of some description that led the early development of the commercialized olive industry?
I think the Costa family had their roots in Northern Paarl and the beginning of the 1900s, and that's what it's grown out of. But I think the addition to that is you need to bear in mind that the production in Europe, where probably 50% of world production is out of Spain, they have a subsidy, and that subsidy can go up to 40% of the cost of production. In addition to that, mass production doesn't necessarily carry the profile of the flavors that we have here, where it is generally smaller producers that have modern equipment and modern varieties. So I think the statement that imported olive oil is cheaper is not necessarily true. If you had to import similar qualities to what we produce in this country, it would sell at far higher costs than what we sell our own oil for.
Do we have an olive oil dumping problem in South Africa? Are we seeing those subsidized oils being imported at uncompetitive pricing?
Absolutely. I wouldn't necessarily call it dumping, but fraud in the olive oil industry is as old as time itself. And passing off superior quality olive oil and fetching a higher price when in fact it is not even extra virgin olive oil happened in Roman times. Nothing new to the world of the olive oil industry.
And you talked about exports. I mean, what percentage of South Africa's olive oil production is exported? Is it a massive business or is it quite small?
It's niche producers that have hammered their marketing and traveled overseas and physically marketed their product. And they've had success not only in selling, but in winning awards across the globe in international competitions. So, we might only produce less than 1% of world production, but we punch far above our weight insofar as awards that we run across the world in international olive oil competitions.
And those competitions are important because that's what gives you, I suppose, the credibility to go on the shelf alongside the household brands, I suppose.
Absolutely. There's an Italian publication, Flossolet, that publishes the top about 500 olive oils of the world each year. And I think in 2020, we had six of our producers that were published in this publication. And certainly out of 500, we have six of them when we're only producing less than 1% of the world's production. It shows you how well we do. Mm-hmm. And across the globe, across in the New York annual olive oil competition, and as far as Japan, our producers continue to win awards year in, year out.
So the olive oil industry is booming. What about the berries? What are they? The olives themselves?
When you say the olives themselves, in terms of production?
Are we consuming the olives we produce here? Are we converting them all to oil? Are we exporting any of those olives? What's happening with the actual fruit?
The actual fruit in table, you're referring to table olives, it's probably 50-50. We import 50% and we produce 50% of our consumption. Whereas the South African oil consumption, we only produce a third of what we consume in South Africa. So I think the gripe that most South African producers have is that we are competing against subsidized imports, which are keeping people in the European Union in employment at the expense of employing our own people in South Africa.
Is it a growing industry in South Africa, or has it reached some sort of plateau?
No, I think there's continued to be plantings. Obviously, the last 3 years, the majority of the production is in the Western Cape. And as you well know, we had drought over a three-year period. So that's maybe been a slight hiccup. But the rains have returned to normal as of last year and again this year, and we expect plantings to continue. The interesting thing is the olive industry tags along with the wine industry and the fruit industry, and harvest time is normally post the harvest of these other agricultural products. So you do have an opportunity to extend the employment of seasonal workers for an extra 3 to 4 months. So it's not just a window of opportunity of 4 months of picking. You add on the olives onto the end of that, and people would gain employment for 8 to 9 months of the year. And we featured highly in the national development program that the government put forward. But unfortunately, that's never really been kicked into production, you know, to try and follow suit and favor getting more olives planted in South Africa.
How long does it take for a tree to produce fruit? I mean, what is it? Is it a 4, 5, 6 year process?
Yeah, you will get, depending on the planting and variety, but you'll get a fly crop in the third year. And you'll get into bigger production fourth and fifth year and full production by year 6 or 7.
So it's a long-term game, this. I mean, you know, it's an expensive process. You've got to have the land, you've got to plant the trees, you've got to nurture the trees, look after the trees, love the trees. And finally, 6 or 7 years later, you start getting a decent crop.
Well, I guess it's not too different to any of the tree crop varieties in South Africa. But, you know, if the trend is correct in the world, they are planting 5 to 7 trees every second. And world production is expected to double over the next 15 to 20 years. So the big money and the trend analysts are predicting that there will be bigger and bigger consumption of olive oil. And like I'm sure as you once were a student, you started by simply quaffing maybe cheap wine. And as your palate developed, you recognized you needed to get the premium product. And I think that's what we're facing across the world as people, as they become more educated. And the saying goes, until you've tasted good olive oil, you don't know how bad olive oil tastes.
I'm told that Chateau Libertas is drinking well this year. I must try. Thank you, Nick Wilkinson, chairman of SA Olive. A third time lucky. CEO at Truth, Amanda Cromhout. Earth to Amanda. Are you with us this time?
Hey, Bruce. Sorry about that.
I'm right here. That's all right. Well, good to have you. Amanda, talk to me about how many rewards programs we've got in South Africa.
Yeah, we've got lots and lots, and you love them all, I know. So we've got, I think, well in excess of 100, but obviously there's lots and lots of iterations of all of them, so there's partnerships and so forth. So it's quite difficult to distinguish individual programs these days because there's so many that are linked to each other.
The same names keep coming up in the winner's circle. Checkers is new this year. I think best program of the year in retail, best newcomer went to ShopRite. They really have pushed the boat out in terms of, for years, sitting on the sidelines of the rewards programs, being quite dismissive of rewards programs. And when they've launched with a bang.
Absolutely. And as you say, they've sat watching, saying, we're not doing this. And then they've done it and they've gone big and they've gone bold. So, yep, best retailer program, Checkers, and then newcomer, ShopRite. And then also Checkers picked up the best strategic use of data analytics, so how they're applying the data that they collect through the program to give a better experience, better value back to their customers.
Because, I mean,
the
ShopRite
group actually picked up 3 awards in the total awards.
I mean, let's face it, the purpose of the rewards is to make you as a customer feel like you're getting a little bit of something back. But the true value in these rewards is for the company to better understand how you behave and what you think and what you do and what you shop. And in some way to then feed back to you in the same way as Facebook tells you what you're thinking, what you want to buy and how you buy it.
Absolutely. And I know you've interviewed so many practitioners about the data side, but obviously now the data legislation is much stricter, which is great. It really protects the consumer, but also allows brands to do this in a meaningful way rather than just this crazy sort of collect data and then do random spamming. It's now very controlled, and certainly the retailers are using that data to target exactly what I want and give me value back on what I want, not just what they want to push. Well, that's the premise anyway, so let's hope they continue to do it. And Checkers got recognized for that in both of the awards they won, and obviously ShopRite is slightly newer into the game. We also saw on exactly that point the Fashini Group picking up best short-term loyalty marketing campaign because of their absolutely phenomenal use of the data they collect across all the different brands.
Good, because there's been so much data for so long and nobody's quite known what to do with it, but it seems to be becoming more and more refined. Why is it that nobody in the banking sector can unseat eBucks? I think eBucks has been top of the pops for, I don't know, probably since the beginning almost.
Top of the pops. Yeah, so we've actually been running these awards for 3 years. I'm not a judge. I'm the judging chair, so this isn't my voice speaking. I'm just speaking on behalf of the judges. We have 11 judges. And eBucks has won consistently for the 3 years. But it also, remember, last time you and I spoke, I announced the results of the loyalty brand, Truth and Brand Map white paper, which talks about loyalty usage as consumers' research voted for it, and they come out as the single program that South Africans can't live without as a loyalty program. So why, I guess, is your question. They don't charge fees. They give enormous value back. They encourage you to redeem your e-bucks. They've got an enormous partnership network, and it's a very easy program to be part of. It's seamless. It's frictionless. I don't really have to jump through any loops other than use my F&B card.
Yeah, and that's
bank,
the...
And bank differently at F&B.
It's the simplicity aspect. Thank you, Amanda Cromote, Chief Executive at Truth.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, and coming up after Eyewitness News at 7:30, a guy who will clean your bed. And then on your bedside table will leave a jar filled with what he has extracted from your mattress. And if you have a cast iron constitution, you can look at it. You might even take it and look at it under a microscope. And if you've ever watched the videos of the microscopic stuff that can live in your mattress, you won't sleep again until you get your bed clean. But he's created a business, and he is taking this business global, and it's a really fascinating story. We'll talk to Charlie Wright in just a little while about Clean My Bed. The Money Show, brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
With Colin Cullis.
Colin Cullis is our Business Unusual correspondent. And what is unusual in South Africa in terms of business is trains. We don't have many of them. The Sishen-Saldanha line is very good. I'm told that the line from Roslyn to Gqeberha to the port in Mucha working well in terms of vehicle exports. But if you're trying to get a commuter train anywhere in South Africa, you better not hold your breath because you may pass out due to a lack of oxygen. We've allowed our rail networks to become severely denuded and in some cases could destroy it completely. South Africa's latest national sport is cable theft. And kilometres of the stuff are being stolen on a daily basis, and we're seeing a huge amount of cable theft. We're also seeing a huge amount of railway sleepers being stolen as people just remove entire railway lines as there's no traffic and there's no disruption to their extramural activities. But Colin Cullis seems to think, and I hope he's right, that there's an enormous opportunity still for rail in South Africa. Is there, Colin?
Yes, there is. And I suppose the starting point for that, Bruce, would have to be that South Africa is lucky or has worked hard enough in the past to actually build up the most comprehensive network on all the continent. There are tens of thousands of kilometers of rail infrastructure right across the country for most of the seriously economic regions and a lot of places connecting those to sort of minor economic regions, to the point where if you had to add up all of the kilometers of track available to the other countries, and certainly SADC countries, we absolutely dominate that. But the challenge has been, you know, how it's been used. And that's led to the current state, and unfortunately not a short-term problem and not a short-term fix. It is worth noting, though, I'd hardly think I'd be talking about railways as a business unusual, high-tech, fancy, amazing, but rail was our original transport industrial revolution. Before that, the only things we could claim for saying, wow, that was brilliant, was domesticating animals that would allow us to sit on them or get a wheel. And of course, the railway, that original notion of taking the steam engine, which created the industrial revolution, which is very heavy and very hard to control, so sticking it on a track, making it run in a very straight line or as straight as possible, did wonders for being able to transport everything everywhere. It did create a lot of chaos initially, but nevertheless, we find ourselves now with a fantastic mode of transport that is in a very, very bad state. One, as you say, cable theft. This is the issue that has got it in the news at the moment. Kilometers per day sometimes being stolen. Absolute fortunes to replace while not being able to use the service. And almost as soon as the services are returned, the cables get stolen again.
Yeah.
Then there is the issue of the pandemic and people not being able to move. And as a consequence of that and the much longer term problem with state capture, and particularly some questionable security deals, it appears that many stations and sections of rail, because there was nobody around, had been focused on and absolutely destroyed. Whole stations that are basically need to be rebuilt. In Cape Town, the same issues where trains effectively couldn't run allowed desperate people who were in need of housing to effectively build their homes on the tracks. And the notion of saying, well, you know, just kick people out, hardly something you do during a pandemic, but leaving them there and not allowing a network that could transport thousands of people per day very efficiently, very cheaply, is a non-starter. It cannot be allowed to continue. And there are some thoughts that say, as the shift from sort of illegal mining has become less and less profitable and more dangerous, then, you know, mining natural resources that occur on the long side of railway tracks or power lines is becoming a good alternative. And then, of course, this is all compounded by the very wrong choices that have been made repeatedly by the government, thinking it can have the best of both worlds without understanding this is a very big infrastructure project and needs to be treated that way. Last week, we spoke about this notion of a just transition, and the rail network is one of those occasions where South Africa got the just transition wrong. This is an intro from a documentary that was done, and I want to read it to you, and then I'll give you the date, because you'll get some sense from there. Once the center of South Africa's economy and life, the railway network is now withered and died, leaving those that have been dependent on it with nothing. Once thriving towns lie derelict, the last few residents barely scratching a living. These towns were built for the railway. They supplied its workers and its commerce. But now the railway has become so inefficient, it is no longer economical. The government is left with a quandary: to sell off the railways or to try to revitalize it with public funds. That was an excellent piece done by that grand old documentary show called Special Assignment in 2001. Two decades later, the same issue needs to be addressed, except at that time, they were showing how when at the time Spoornet did decide to simply shut down anything that wasn't worth it as they pulled their head in to cut costs, left communities right across the country that had were built up alongside those railway lines to fall into complete dereliction and disrepair. And so that, in some respects, is something we do want to avoid, because at some point, those nodes will become vital again. And so you don't just abandon them and think, oh, well, we'll rebuild it when they come back. That is crazily expensive. So make sure that you can do it in a way that is manageable. The other element with the rail network that has been, let's not say a misstep, but something that people didn't consider properly at the time, was as the opportunities with road infrastructure started improving and the flexibility that trucking gave and containerization gave effectively meant that trains with their very regimented time schedules and very specific pickup and drop-off points became less flexible than a truck that could arrive with varying sizes at any time of the day or night, pick up your load, ride through to exactly where you need to deliver it, and drop it off. Now, that has led to part of what we have as the problem. And of course, anybody that's been on the roads will tell you that having to dodge trucks and drive up and down is, you know, that's not the ideal. But this is where we find ourselves. And unfortunately, even with the most recent recovery plan that the government has put out, it is littered with the kind of notions of saying we have to do this very big infrastructure program, but effectively we're trying to do transformation and give small businesses an opportunity to become part of the economy. And quite honestly, that's not what you do with big infrastructure projects. Big infrastructure projects allow small businesses to get the, you know, enable themselves to be able to move things around cheaply, efficiently, to be able to get workers to and from wherever they want to live to where they need to get to for those jobs. You don't try and have a small company run a rail network any more so than you'd have some small company try and supply coal or build power stations. There are very specific competences you need. And if you don't have them, those people should not be looking to take part. Now, that's not to say that there isn't an opportunity for that, because there is, but just not in the way that the government seems to want to keep going backwards to do those things. In this particular one, what they seem to be suggesting is that the trouble is with their procurement and the time it takes to procure something. And so by reducing those things, not cutting red tape, by giving people the chance to say, I can fudge things or cut a corner, we're just setting ourselves up for the exact same trouble that led to us getting here in the first place. So that's the sort of general issue of the state of the network. But it's probably also useful as a bit of a primer to understand, how does this all work? Because again, as I disappear down the rabbit hole that is the railway networks and becoming a minor league train spotter over the last 2 days, it is really quite fascinating. So first of all, I suppose the notion is how many track gauges we get. And I kind of assumed train tracks are train tracks and the trains run on them. But there are 15 different widths of train track, from very narrow ones to the very broad ones. South Africa has opted for the generally speaking, they call it the Cape Gauge, but it's generally a more narrow track, about a meter wide, which favors if you have to cut through mountain passes and very tricky terrain, well, then you're not using up too much space, so it's a lot cheaper to do that. The wider tracks, we do have one of them, it's the Gautrain, it's called the Standard Gauge, about 1.4 meters. That allows for speed and comfort. So the Gautrain is capable of reaching speeds of up to 160 k's an hour because it has the wider track. The rest of the train network is probably capped at somewhere around 100, 120 for safety's sake, given the width of it. And then there's the kind of trains that run on them. And most of us assume, well, there's the electric trains and then there's the diesel trains, when in fact the diesel train is simply an electric train with a diesel generator on it. So it doesn't need the overhead wires in order to power the trains, but it uses the big diesel engine basically to run the generator, and that powers the electric one. And that, unfortunately, is one of the things that PRASA, Metrorail, Transnet has had to resort to having to use in urban areas because the amount of interruptions there's been to cable theft. And while they are very effective for getting you long distances when there isn't that infrastructure, running big diesel engines in urban areas make a racket, are very polluting and are very expensive to run compared to the sort of electric ones. And so that is a big hassle. The high-tech version that's coming down the line, not that it's high-tech, but it's just new, is the hydrogen fuel cell electric trains. And there, I think there is some possibilities for us to be able to address that. But that's going to be a little further down the line. The actual fixing would come with us identifying those hotspots where the networks are regularly affected, and specifically looking to build in things. Some people are saying get drones flying everywhere. I think that's over-engineering it. The circuits are broken up into sections. When the power is cut, you can tell you've lost power. By adding in smaller increments, because sometimes those circuits are kilometers long, you can see where along that line the power has been cut, and effectively make sure you've got rapid response teams in those areas, time how long it take you to get to the various parts, so that you're not getting there to see that the cables have been cut and stolen. You're getting there to see that the cables have been cut. So the issue isn't replacing cable, it's simply reconnecting it. Big rewards potentially for the big fish that are organizing this make sense to me, because it's not a case of, I just got myself 5 kilometers of copper cable, I'll pop down to the local scrap shop and get myself some cash. This is way more organized than that. So being able to take it out at the top should mean nobody's going to have the infrastructure and the time and the ability to get hold of it. And then the final one, and this is where the hydrogen comes back in, is to get rid of the cables altogether. Now, it's not really a practical thing for us in the short term, but railways aren't built for 5-year cycles or 10-year cycles. They're built to last for centuries. And here the hydrogen fuel cell trains, which are being pioneered at the moment by a company called Alstom, happens to be the same company that South Africa has partnered with to build the Gabela consortium in Dunatar. I did not even know where that was in South Africa.
Dunatar.
My apologies.
Yeah, come on.
It could be the site for the resurgence of all South Africa's things, because that is where Alstom has a PRASA coordinated building thing. They're busy building all of the rolling stock that once the train stations are fixed and the cables are sorted, the trains can be rolling out from there. But using this hydrogen fuel cell, one, it uses literally hydrogen and oxygen. It makes water. That is the sum total of what it puts out. Mm. It is silent while it does that, and it provides electricity. That is probably going to be the way forward. It's probably some years down the line. We need to be more realistic about how we identify the short-term problems if we're going to tackle this thing seriously.
If we're going to have a business at all by the time they're ready, because I just yesterday in the Transaction Capital results, and Transaction Capital, amongst the other things that they do, help taxi owners own their taxis. They fund about 15% of the taxis on South Africa's roads. They say there's been a 64% drop in the use of rail between 2013 and 2020. And that's hardly surprising, because rail has just deteriorated so badly. They've pushed their customers onto the roads. The roads are therefore more congested, more taxis on the roads, more rage, more frustration, more. Good for the profits of Transaction Capital, but dreadful for everybody else, including the people who have been forced into the taxis. I'm sure they'd much rather use rail, and hopefully it makes a comeback. Thank you, Colin Cullis. Business Unusual on a Wednesday evening.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Consumer Ninja. Wendy Nola is with us this evening. Wendy Nola, the Capitec story is one that you've been looking at in some detail, and now you're tackling queues at Capitec. Is it really that bad?
Well, you'll remember we spoke about why is it that Capitec's ATMs always have the longest queues when you know, not only is this, you know, very time consuming to draw money that way, but as a Capitec customer, you're paying R7.50 per 1,000 rand, plus there's a lot of ATM fraud that happens, and you know, a lot of people are complaining to the banking ombudsman as Capitec customers about that, because there's a simpler, cheaper, safer way to do it. You can go to a supermarket till and you can withdraw money for a flat fee of 160. So we were pondering this, we were perplexed, and so was Capitec as to why the queues persist. And two very sharp listeners with some insights into why this happens has since got hold of me, and I thought it was pertinent to share. So an LR Malele says, the reason is that cashiers can't just open the till when you ask for money. They tell you you must also buy something so that they can open the till. I checked with Capitec and they said, yes, that is the case with some of them. He says, well, you know, if you're on a grant and now you've got to buy something that you weren't intending to buy, that's a problem. Because you can't just buy something for 5 cents at a supermarket, right? And then something really interesting, Bruce, that he added or she added, and that is, yes, you can say that you must just withdraw your money when you're buying your groceries anyway. Well, the thing is, they said, people, especially in the rural areas, they go to the shops maybe once a month, and while they're at the shops or in the mall, they're going to do window shopping first and then maybe get their hair done. And doing the groceries is the last thing they do, even though it's the main thing that brought them to town. And the thing is that all those traders doing their hair, etc., want their money in cash. So I thought that was just so interesting as to, you know, why we see the long queues in the supermarket. And then George Gumede said, the reason is that you get attitude and you're sent around from till to till. If you're trying to draw 1,000 rand, because mostly they don't have that money. So people would rather stand in long queues and deal with at the ATMs and deal with cashiers when they're requesting their own money. So they don't feel respected. And Charles Null, who's Capitec's comms guy, said, yes, when the tills have just been opened and they open their float, there's not a lot of money in it. And then they do ask clients to go to another till, but normally it's only when a till is opened. So I just am indebted to those listeners to
wonderful feedback,
for sharing that with us, because, you know, we're a country of so many different kinds of consumers. And so there, we did some market research for Capitec free.
Hey, aren't you so generous? And so on to then today's topic, and it is it really is one of understanding the details of the banking sector. The banking adjudicator has been incredibly busy.
They have. And so informally, I get to hear about a lot of these cases. And when I heard about this one, I said, oh, please, can I share it? I can't name the bank, unfortunately. But I just love it because it's it goes around communication and disclosure and appropriate ways of doing that with your older clients. And something, I mean, the OBS, the banking, the Ombudsman for Banking Services, is very strong on forcing the banks, or strongly encouraging the banks to deal with vulnerable consumers, of which elderly consumers make up the biggest portion of those. And it really does expect the banks to go extra mile for their older customers. So in this case, the customer was fairly wealthy because he had a private banker. And he had been told by his private banker that if he maintained a balance of 75,000 in his account, all fees would be waived. And he rather liked that idea, naturally. But 6 months on the 1st of June last year, he was sent an SMS advising him of a pricing change, as these banks like to do, from no fee to 400 rand a month. And he wasn't aware of that SMS. So in 6 months or so went by before he became aware of it, and he complained to the Ombud. And the bank felt that they did nothing wrong. But this is the interesting part. The Ombud said, why didn't you, this is a private banker after all, why didn't you phone this customer alerting him to this rather significant change rather than just sending out, you know, an SMS? And the answer was, none of the bankers are obliged to follow up on each of their clients to ensure that their clients have read and understood the new pricing rules, as we were not sent a database of these clients who were affected by the no fees waiver. Well, the question is, why not? There's technology for that. So the OBS adjudicator on the case said, that's not good enough. It's not unreasonable to expect a private banker to call a customer and inform them of the price change. Perhaps it would have been more prudent for the banker to have informed the customer back in December of 2019 during the initial call about the no-fee thing, if you have $75,000 in your account, of the possibility that this no-fee option could change when the new pricing schedule was issued. This would be providing the customer with clear information and would have absolved the bank from any allegations of a customer service breakdown. And they strongly advised that the bank reimburse the fees levied on that account from July 2020 to December 2020 when the new fee came to his attention. And it was an amount of just over 2,000 Rand, 2,065. The bank pushed back. The adjudicator pushed back some more and said a one-size-fits-all approach, i.e. sending an SMS, will not suffice. The private banker should have mentioned, you know, as we've already said. And then if he'd known, he could have explored other options. And finally, the bank said, oh, all right then, and refunded that money. And I think it sends an important message to that bank and others about the way they choose to communicate with their clients, especially their well-heeled elderly ones, the ones who have private bankers and expect more from them. And, you know, it also tells us what we can expect from our bankers if we, you know, that we don't have to, if this sort of, you know, SMSs are often mostly spam from your bank, right?
Absolutely. They're wanting to, don't care. Don't sell read you that way. Nonsense. Absolutely. It's all junk. Well, the important stuff then. Sneaks through. So tell me, Wendy, I mean, I don't know if you've ever looked at the pricing guide from your bank. I don't know if you've ever tried to read the pricing guide from your bank, whether or not you've got that much time in your life to read the pricing guide and understand the pricing guide and interpret the pricing guide and then to be able to successfully apply what you've learned from the pricing guide to your everyday activity. It's challenging.
It's something I do try to do because, you know, I have to walk my talk a little bit. I don't always do it, but normally what happens is we find out, as did this bank customer, when it really hits us on our bank statement and we go, what is this? It did take 6 months, hence that 2,000 Rand had accrued in fees, but that he'd paid. But yeah, you're right. I think in many, many stories that I've covered involving bank fees, the upshot is that, you know, they just left you, please see our pricing guide. They don't, they're not really that into disclosure around how the fees are going to change. And in this case, the ombudsman quite rightly felt that they didn't do enough. They didn't tell him up front that it could change. I mean, from 0 to 400 Rand a month is quite significant.
Sure.
I think it happens. I think I'm quite sure there'll be some listeners thinking, yeah, that happened to me, and maybe I should have a word with my bank, and that would be a good thing.
Can I alert you? I don't think it's a schlenter. I think it's a genuine mistake, but it's something I picked up because I do check my bank statements, and I'm a big fan of using credit cards, and I'm a big fan of paying off my credit card in full each and every single month as and when it becomes due. There's an automatic payment that the bank triggers, and it helps itself out of my current account. And because I'm a disciplined individual, there's always enough money in the account to make sure that I can pay the card off in full. So I get free credit from the bank and free transactions when I swipe my card, and it's all well and good. This month, I noticed a big fat interest charge on my credit card account, and I questioned it and was told that usually the debit order runs on the first of the month. But this year, because there was a public holiday on the 1st of November for Election Day, the debit orders ran the day after, except nobody at the bank thought to go, oh, we really shouldn't levy any interest on this. I then get very defensive about this sort of stuff, and I approached the bank and I said, hold on a second, but does that mean that if I hadn't noticed it, it wouldn't have been refunded? They assured me that the amount would be refunded at the end of this month. But it just leaves such a bad taste in the mouth that sort of error can occur. And because of a lack of trust, you know, people are going to feel like they're being screwed over, whether they are or not.
Exactly. It's certainly something they should have foreseen, because there are many people like you, Bruce, who do exactly that. They pay in full every month. They have that automated thing go off so that they never pay any interest, and gives them a lot of satisfaction. I'm sure you can relate. But they should have foreseen that this would happen, and that huge interest would then be there because you're deemed not to have paid in full and on time.
And then it affects your credit record as well.
I'm glad you made a stink.
And it affects your credit record.
Yes, exactly. Well, we can speak privately about which bank that was, Bruce, and I'll find out if they automatically did that to everybody who was affected in the way you were, and let's make sure that was the case rather than you only get a refund if you speak up.
I think so. Well worth it. I'm so glad I raised it. Thank you, Wendy Nola, consumer ninja Wendy Nola. I'm scared, and she's on my side.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
If you're a regular listener to The Money Show, you should know by now that we love nothing more than great ideas, scalable businesses, particularly businesses that can be taken global, businesses that can make a fundamental difference, businesses that are born out of an attempt to solve a problem. And I've come across a business called Clean My Bed. And it's pretty gross. Well, not the business. The problem it solves is pretty gross. The business is designed to, let me get Charlie Wright to tell the story. He's the founder of Clean My Bed. And we'll get to the gory stuff in just a bit, Charlie. But why do I need Clean My Bed?
Good evening, Bruce. Thank you very much indeed for having me. You need Clean My Bed for a start because, let's face it, every human being on this earth secretes a natural phenomenon of something like 500 million skin cells a day. And we do the majority of that in our beds. And what that produces is a staple diet for dust mites. Now, dust mites eat our skin cells, and in doing so, and in quite natural means, they also need to relieve themselves. So, they do exactly that in our beds as well. So
the dust mites poo in your bed. The dust mites eat your skin and poo in your bed. That's what they do.
That's exactly what they do. That's exactly what they do. And, it's a complete natural phenomenon. We are sitting and lying in compounded layers and layers of dust mite poo that we compound into our beds on a nightly basis. And it's this, not the dust mites and not our skin cells, it's this that's triggering things like our allergies and runny noses and itchy eyes and sore throats. So
now your background is you lived in Dubai for many years. You ran big events, and eventually I think you got fed up of running big events and moved to Cape Town, where you live now. And you were kind of, I think, sitting at your desk and pondering what you were going to do next. And I think you sat staring at a blank wall for about a year before one day looking across the room at your young daughter, hold on a second. She's got terrible allergies. How do I solve this problem? So that led to some research, which suddenly led to the eureka moment of Clean My Bed. Take me through that process.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, brilliant. Thank you for that. You stole my thunder there. I was just going to recount all of that, but, let me first of all start by saying that Clean My Bed in itself should have been around about 20 years ago. In a nutshell, it's a medical-grade sanitizing service dedicated to all our well-beings while we're in our beds. Now, as you say, about 18 months ago, when trying to find a sustainable solution to what was becoming an ongoing issue that was driving my wife and I up the wall at the time, was our daughter's constant allergy issues. She'd wake up in this bedraggled state with runny noses, itchy eyes, and all brought on by what we thought was dust mites. Up until this point, we'd been spending a great deal of money on a regular basis on medicines and cortisones and eye drops and all the rest of it that we were sort of throwing at the problem, which was simply a temporary respite before it all needed to be applied again, because what's happening is here, we shed skin cells on a regular basis, you can remove it, but it all starts over again, and you've just got to keep on top of this. So going down this route, I needed to find some sort of clarity on why and what it was that was causing all of this. And I've just said, it was at that moment that the penny dropped. And we were able to do a little bit of research into what everyone else was doing, and no one was really doing anything about this white elephant in the room that was our beds. We sit that we get we wash ourselves, we get into clean clothes, we put new sheets onto our beds. But when do we ever look at that white elephant in the room and give him or her a decent clean? We never do.
And why would it not work for me simply to vacuum my mattress? I've got a vacuum cleaner. It's got a good suction on it. I could whip my sheets off, put them in the sun, vacuum the bed. Surely that's the job done.
Yeah. So while the intention is right, and because that's exactly what we should be doing, removing all of this dust, mite, fecal matter, the problem with this is that not all vacuum cleaners are the same. And there is, if you like, what's called the HEPA filtration process, which is, in effect, a Rolls-Royce filtration system that is fitted to the majority of vacuum cleaners going forward. But the HEPA device, the HEPA filter on it, is a means of retaining the majority of what you are sucking up and not filtering it back into the air again. So unless you've got one of these filters attached to your vacuum cleaner, all you're really doing is moving the grime from one spot to another and kicking out a vast majority of it in the filter behind. So it's essential that if you're going to do this and try and do this at home on your own, is that you find the right means of extracting the first part of the process.
Okay, so I mean, we're lying to ourselves. We think we can do it with our regular vacuum cleaner with its bag attached and stuff, and the pipes that invariably leak and all of that sort of stuff. So we're fibbing to ourselves. So you sit there and you've got the modern wonder of the internet, and you start looking for solutions, global solutions, and you track down a bloke, an engineer, in Australia, I think, and he has got a machine that he's not commercializing. He's not using it in a way that you think is appropriate. And where did you go from there?
Okay, so good point. So, as I say, 18 months ago, this all happened, and at the same time, there was an awful lot of noise around the sort of the sanitizing and the various sanitizing processes. And I was introduced to this chap, as you say, an engineer in Australia, who had been manufacturing a piece of equipment for hospitals. And it was a UVC device. Now, a UVC device, UVC is ultraviolet germicidal light. And this device had basically been built to sanitize hospital beds in seconds. And he had taken this thing to market and was doing very little with it from a hospitality angle, which is when he approached us and said, did we think that there was any market for this in hospitality? Which is when we really put our heads together and deemed it very, very appropriate and applicable. And we have since taken these devices, brought them to market, and are now scaling a business where we apply a two-part process to a business that we can scale out beyond the borders of South Africa.
And this is the interesting bit, which we're going to get to in just a moment. But these machines you're now building in South Africa, you're creating the package of goodies that you, I suppose, you call your people ambassadors, but I guess they're franchisees. And they go out into the world, go and clean beds, and you then get a cut of every bed that's cleaned. It is a classic franchise model.
Right. Well, so for want of a better expression, our business model could, let's put it this way, we're trying to sort of stay away from this idea of it being a franchise because we've sort of turned it on its head somewhat. But for want of a better expression, our business model could be likened to that of an Uber equivalent, if you like, with very clear distinctions. Our ambassadors are presented with an opportunity where it's not taken because it's very important that the right ambassadors are chosen for this. They're then invited in and because of the traits that they possess, because going out and cleaning people's beds, if you like, and making creating this not much a phobia around it, but cleaning people's beds is a very personal experience. So the people, the ambassadors we appoint, if you like, have particular traits that are ingrained around people's skills. And unlike a traditional franchise model, there's no buy-in fee to clean my bed. Instead, the ambassadors are provided with all the equipment, all the technology, the branding, and all the back of house administrative processes that go with it to enable them to go out and service their own clients. And this is the other thing about our business model is that it is not confined by geography or defined by geography. So you could have two ambassadors, if you like, living on the same street, but servicing completely different market sectors themselves. And, you know, what we're doing is actually empowering individuals with a business in a box to effectively go out there and do their own thing and, I suppose, effectively creating jobs.
What I like about this concept, Charlie, sorry, is the fact that you're actually creating micro enterprises. You're creating businesses, and people can either hire people to help them. They can get multiple machines, and they can do it. But we'll pick up on that in just a moment. Charlie Wright, the founder of a business called Clean My Bed, born out of frustration, rage, and you know, real difficulty with his daughter struggling with allergies. Internet research reveals there's a machine that exists. You bring the machine concept to South Africa. You build it in South Africa. You put a business in a box, and then you start exporting this business to people in different cities initially, and then potentially in different countries. More on that with Charlie Wright in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
A long, long time ago when I was at university, I remember going for a weekend to Kenton-on-Sea. Beautiful place. Dodgy accommodation I chose because it was cheap. And two or three weeks after this dodgy accommodation, I developed these extraordinary itchy rashes. Oh, my goodness gracious me. Eventually managed to find some cream and it all went away. Then those were bed bugs. The bed bugs did bite. Charlie Wright is in the business of stopping the bed bugs from biting. He's the founder of a startup called Clean My Bed. How many ambassadors have you got now, Charlie? How many of these businesses in a box have you built?
Okay, good question. Bruce, before I answer that, as it's very clear, I mean, I've got to make a clear distinction. We are not in the business of removing bed bugs from beds. Bed bugs are insects. People will see bed bugs. We're in the business of removing allergens that trigger asthmas, eczemas, rhinitis, gotcha, and what have you, through dust mites. And dust mites are microscopic. You cannot see them, but it's as I say, there's a very clear distinction between the two.
Well, thank you. I didn't know this. They wear different shirt colours and things. I didn't know that. Now I've learned something new. Thank you, Charlie. I just like the line, the bed bugs don't bite, but hey, steal my line. It's fine. How many of these businesses in a box have you built?
So in South Africa now, we are probably up to our 20 ambassadors across the country. And this is in the last sort of 12 months. I say 12 months, it's over the last 6 months that we've introduced 20 ambassadors to the country. And they're in KZN, and they're in Johannesburg and Pretoria and across the Western Cape, up the Garden Route as well. And that's just in South Africa. But the word has got out purely through awareness that we've sort of projected or deployed, if you like, into the across the social media, and words got out, and we've now got we've had inquiries from as far away as US Virgin Islands to take the business over there, and we have now, we're about to sort of launch in the UK and in Norway, Ireland, the UAE and Switzerland are also on our cards for the first quarter of 2022. So it's really taken off. And the simplicity behind this is so simple. We're in the business of removing allergens from people's beds so they can sleep better. And there's no wizardry behind this. There's no bells or whistles. It's something that is so natural in all of our beds, and something that we subconsciously we know we should be doing, but we don't do anything about it.
There are no chemicals in the process. This isn't some sort of chemical deep clean. It's using UV light. It's using suction. It's taking up the allergens out of the bedding and out of the mattresses. And these businesses that you are rolling out then, I mean, will you continue to build and develop and to export the businesses in a box out of South Africa? Is that the plan?
Absolutely. I mean, it really is exactly that. We should have been around 20 years ago. And by simple awareness, we are creating micro, or if you like, sort of independent businesses in a box for people all over the show. And it's wonderful to see.
It's an amazing story, Charlie, right? Thank you for sharing it. Founder at a business called Clean My Bed, the idea. It's the light bulb moment. It emerges, builds a business, creates the systems, the processes, after about a year of really struggling. And this guy going, what am I going to do? And suddenly the idea hits when you least expect it. It was to solve the problem of his daughter's allergies. Charlie writes.